Greetings, and welcome to the Cat Options Reporting Deep Dive New York conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. I would now like to turn the conference over to Shelley Boland. Please go ahead.
Great, thank you. And I'm actually going to turn it over and kick it off to Jim Hyde, Senior Director of NYSE, a board member of Stanny and FCA. Get us started.
Thank you. Well, welcome, of course. So Jim Hyde here at NYSE. I run the business development for the two option platforms. As noted, I'm also a Stanny and FCA board member. So near and dear to my heart is educational-type webinars and events like this. So we take them very seriously at those organizations and, of course, in this building as well. So that being said, I'll be short. We have about an hour of long presentation slash webinar. And with that being said, I would like to ask a question of the room. Who has attended either by phone or in person in the room? So obviously I can't tell for the webinar folks, but in the room has attended the Chicago similar event, which we plan to build on here in New York. Were you in person or on the phone?
Phone.
Any in person? Phone. So I have a small prize, a little gift in my pocket for whoever. But save it for next time. So if there's going to be another one, I'll make sure the gift goes. So I'm going to leave it with Brandy, who, of course, is with that. So were you in person?
There you go.
No cheating. It's regulation and compliance. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Shelley, and thank you very much for joining this event here at NYSE.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim. So before we dive into the materials, I just wanted to all introduce ourselves here on the panel. I am Shelley Boland. I'm with FINRA CAT.
Brandy Patterson, NYSE Options.
Judy McDonald, SIG.
And Jennifer Lumpy, CEO.
Great. So if we can, on the WebEx, go ahead and turn to the agenda. And this is on, the presentation is online. We're trying to save trees here. We don't have printouts, but it's available online already. We'll republish again with a recording from today, so you can go back and listen again to the presentation. So if we can move on to the agenda page. What we're going to be covering today is the options implementation timelines, very important for 2B. And a big focus of today will be 2B, the first phase. There's also a second phase, but we're focused today on that first phase. We're also going to go over some of the changes that we've made to the IAM tech spec in version 2.0 from previous versions. There have been some changes that are fairly key for on the option side, origin codes. I know people have been focused on that. That's one of the changes we'll get into. Then we're really where the meat of the presentation is, and hopefully what will help illustrate and bring it to life is walking through some actual workflows. And we have quite a variety of workflows in the presentation to walk through and demonstrate what's reportable when, et cetera. And then we're going to have an update on the OSI symbology list when that will be published. We will be publishing that, a registration reminder. And then we also have information ready to go over the FDID. There's a lot of material to get through in an hour, so anyone who was on the Chicago call knows we took the entire hour. So if we can work through some of the flows, the workflows, rather quickly. Some of them get a little bit repetitive. There are just different permutations, and save a little bit of time, we can get into the FDID. And I don't think we have a hard stop at 5:30, so if at 5:30, you know, obviously everyone needs to leave that needs to leave, but we'll be available afterwards, too, to answer questions. So if anyone has one-on-one questions they want to ask, we'll be happy to answer that. Okay, so let's go ahead and dive in then to the implementation timelines for 2B. So In the options space, we have large firms and small firms. It's a very clear delineation. Unlike equities where we have OATS reporters that are small firms that are being accelerated, we don't have anything like that in options. So the line between small and large firms is $500,000 in total capital. So if you have less than $500,000 in total capital, you're a small firm. Otherwise, you're a large firm, and that's under the SEC rule. So it's not similar to any of the OATS small firms, anybody who might be familiar with that space. All right, so let's talk about how we're rolling this out for large firms. And this has been a little bit of a difference from the previous timelines that had been announced with the change in CAT processor, with FINRA CAT coming in. We are incrementally rolling out the validations, and I'll describe this. Part of this is to allow the processor to have the time that it needs to complete all the development and testing that needs to happen before we are able to externally expose the environment to broker-dealers. And then also a lot of the industry feedback we received, hopefully this type of an incremental approach will help as well as broker-dealers test and roll out. So the first key date is December 16th, 2019, and that is when the industry test environment will open for the first time. And what will be included there is four options. Equity and options are going together in terms of the test environment. So FINRA CAT will be developing in parallel both options and equity. So as soon as equity is available, options is available as well in the test environment. So December 16th test opens. The first thing that will be available in test are the file submission and data integrity validations. So basically, can we read the record? Are the correct types of values in the correct fields, things like that? Do we know the issue symbol? Do we know the IMID? That kind of thing. So you will have from December 16th until May 18th in the test environment to test those validations. There is one thing to note, no mandatory participation in test other than you must successfully be able to submit a file and pass all the validations in test before you will be given access to production. So that, in that sense, it's mandatory. You can't just start out in prod. And starting on May 18th, this is the first implementation date for options. That means that all records, all events that are reportable have to be reported every day, and the data validations will be in place, and any rejected records will have to be repaired and resubmitted by T+3. But that's the only validation that will be in place, those data integrity validations. So you have, what is that, about 6 months to test on those data validations. Then, so we're going to kind of, as you see, this isn't a pure chronological order of these dates because FINRA CAT will be developing in parallel, also the equities, as I mentioned. So April 2020, in the test environment, which of course is a month before prod for data integrity, will enable intra-firm linkage validations in test. So can you put all of the events together inside your own firm in the life cycle of an order? New order routes, if there are children, internal routes, all the different types of things, modifications that can occur, all that has to be linked inside your own firm. So that testing will be enabled in test in April of 2020. Those validations don't go live in production, meaning that you have a regulatory obligation until August of 2020. So that gives you, you know, several months test window for that. Yeah.
One question. As far as the validation goes, is it okay if you're, you know, if you're using a third party to submit for a CAT, can they submit? In other words, if you use Fidessa, for example, and, I mean, if Fidessa submits and obviously everything is okay, will that cover every user on Fidessa, or does every user actually have to submit their own food?
Every user would have to have their own agreement with Fidessa. Everybody has to register themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you're actually doing the validation where you're submitting a file, to make sure.
Oh, I understand what you're saying. I think we're still discussing whether FIDESA can successfully submit and they're good for everybody, if they need to submit something for every individual. We don't have a final answer on that. I think that we're leaning towards having everybody, you know, a file for each individual reporter because there are nuances between the different ones as we experience this in the OATS context. So generally it should be okay, but there's still each one might have their own nuance that might not work. Okay, so then the next thing that will be enabled is the industry member to industry member. So inter-firm linkages will go into test in July. Those will not go to production. That's probably the hardest part, right, of this whole thing is the firm-to-firm. You'll have till December of 2020 before that will go to production. So you'll get that July to December time to test. And we'll also be talking about coordinated industry testing. The first two tranches of this are basically with a single firm. You don't really need a partner to test with on your own data validations or intra-firm linkages. But when we get to inter-firm linkages, that's when you're going to have to figure out, are you matching against particular counterparties, et cetera. So we'll be talking about what kind of planned and organized industry testing. The one thing I would note is that the test environment is a production equivalent environment. We will run full linkages every day. So anybody who's in there, two counterparties, if they want to agree to come in on a particular day, it will, the match cycle will run and will give you results if both sides are there. Okay, and then the final tranche of this is the exchange linkage. So any order routed to an exchange has to link into that exchange. Is data that the exchange itself will be submitting to CAT. That goes to test in September and goes to prod in December. So for large firms to be scoped, full implementation by December 2020.
Shelley?
Yes.
Has there been any more thought about using the production runs prior to linkage, sort of go live as a beta for linkage so we can get that feedback back from the prod?
We are still discussing that internally. We don't have any answer right now, but Michael's point is that because you start reporting all data every day in May, including all the linkage keys, even though we haven't enabled the validations, all the data is there, and you know linkage cycles could be run on them before we drop to prod. So we're talking about what we could be doing prior to even opening the test environment. Okay. Any other questions on the implementation timeframes? All right, if we can move on to the small firm implementation dates. So as I mentioned, any broker-dealer less than $500,000 total capital in the options space has, as you'll see here, I won't go through all of it in detail, but you basically have till December 2021. So you have a year or more on some of these before you come in. There will be no incremental rollout for small firms. It's a single December 2021 date. But keep in mind that the test environment, prod equivalent, have been there since December. So small firms can test as early and as often as they want because nothing is different for a small firm. Other than at the beginning, the linkages, and we'll figure out how not to show unlinked if it's a small firm against a large firm. But other than that, everything's the same. So. And then the final tranche of all of this is, 2D will come in as well in December 2021. That's the more complex part of the scope, including complex orders, paired orders, things like that. And then customer and account data, which is obviously the big game changer here, and there's a lot of work to do there. That's July 2022. I'm sorry. Okay. So let's move on then to when we talk scope for 2B, what specifically do we mean by that? And so as I just mentioned, we've tried to move the most complicated scope to the later implementation dates, recognizing there's more build there, there's more complication to understand both in the processor side and for reporters. So we're trying to go out and get, you know, as much as we can and as soon as we can, starting with these simple electronic orders. And so what exactly does that mean, a simple electronic order? The big thing to pay attention to here is that electronic means that the initial receipt of the order was directly into an OMS in a standard format. So a fixed message or something like that directly into an OMS. It is not you get a phone call and you type it in, or you get a paper ticket and someone turns around and systematizes it. That is not it. The initial receipt has to come directly into your firm electronically. And the same thing outbound. It has to go out directly from an OMS EMS in a standard format. So no IMs, no anything like that. We want to just make that very clear. And it's only simple order, so it excludes electronic pairs. So if we could go on to the next slide, just for the avoidance of doubt and everyone understands what we mean by an electronic paired order, is you're receiving both the buy side and the sell side together as a paired order that you would then be routing on. And those are not reportable in Tool 2D, even though it may have been received electronically. If you get it as a pair, buy and sell together, it's not in Tool 2D. Okay, any questions on that? And hopefully the work, yeah.
If I get in an electronic single order and I find the pair, so I have a single pin, I'm not going to send the electronic route of the pair. I still have something to report.
Yes, and we have that a workflow that we'll look at in just a minute to illustrate that very point because it's a very good question. All right, so if we can move on to the changes in the spec to highlight what has changed since some of our events last, I think, December time frame. So the first big one probably is origin code. So initially we had origin code on all of the options events. So a broker-dealer, three broker-dealers away from the exchange, new order route to the second broker-dealer, route to the third broker-dealer, all of those events had origin code. And I think it created a lot of concern about how that would map to exchange origin codes or what that looked like. And looking to try and make the spec as consistent where possible as it can be with equities, taking a step back and looking at what we're trying to accomplish with the origin code, where we came out is removing that origin code and instead replacing it with an account holder type. And this is just on orders that you initially receive from a customer, meaning not a broker-dealer, not a U.S. registered broker-dealer, so either a two-legged customer, an institution, or a foreign, could be a foreign broker-dealer, but not another CAT reporter. So this is only required on those very top events because we have linkages all the way through everybody who touches it. So we really need to go all the way back to who the original order came from. And this gives us a little bit more granularity and also, like I said, allows us consistency with the equity space to see if it's an institution, if it is an individual, if it's a firm account, whether it's market-making account, not a market-making account, et cetera. So that's a big change. We basically swapped those out. Took origin code off everything, put account holder type on. We also added an affiliate flag so we can tell if you're receiving an order or routing, and we're now putting this on the route as well. This will be coming out in the next iteration of the spec, so we can tell if you're receiving or routing to one of your affiliates. And then originator, I'm not even going to go into what that was. It's all consumed into what we're with now. So that's a big change. That's one of the more fundamental changes. So if we can go into the next slide to let you know what did happen with the exchange origin code. So this is very important on the exchange-facing firm, right? So who is actually routing the order to the exchange? And here we did preserve the exchange origin code only on a route event that goes directly to an exchange. It's not required on any other routes, only from the exchange-facing firm, and it's the exact value you're giving to the exchange. And it is a text value. We are not going to be validating to try and keep up with the exchange. We have the exchange data, so we can easily look and see if there's any issues. But the exchange is reporting as they received the order as well. So that's how we landed on that. Any questions on the origin codes or concerns about?
Do you think it would have to match the exchange origin code?
Not on initial ingestion of the data, so we won't be rejecting it real time. But I'm, you know, I can't say from a regulatory perspective, the exchanges may be looking to see if there's any differences in the values being submitted to CAT versus what they're seeing in the exchange. But it won't be a validation on ingestion that would cause you a rejection.
So we're not a CAT error code.
It's not a CAT error code, no. Okay, anything else? All right, so the next, and we're going to highlight, we'll illustrate this whole concept of an unlinked prior and next unlinked on routes between firms and into exchanges. And we ended up adding this. There's a supplement event in the spec in addition to the new order. So if you don't know at the time you originate your order route and you later are able to add it, you can put it on a supplement event. All right. So with that, let's dive into the actual workflows that will hopefully bring some of this to life a little bit better. And I'm going to turn it over to Brandy, who's going to start us off with, you know, the very basic electronic workflows and what gets reported.
So any order that is sent, an electronic order for the exchange, you will need to send that value. And if it's a BD, if you're going from one BD to another and then send it to exchange, that will all need to be sent next year. Any electronic order sent to the exchange single will be reported next year.
And that's regardless of how many broker-dealers are involved in the chain,
yeah,
right?
Regardless of how many broker-dealers it gets sent to, it needs to be reported next year. Only single-legged.
Only if it's received.
Yes.
That's
or,
right.
Or originates from a product.
Correct.
Right. Right. And so as we dive into these let's move on to, so that's very important. What Brandy just illustrated is all pure electronic, right? Meeting that definition that we talked about directly into. So if we moved on to slide 12 in the presentation, there are many, and you'll see as we illustrate through all of this, many different scenarios that where maybe one firm receives it manually or systematizes it later, but directly electronically routes it. The next firm maybe directly electronically receive it, but then manually routes it. So we will have unlinked by doing the definition the way that we did it, which was in the interest of trying to get as much scope in. I mean, everyone, you know, to state the obvious, we're in a major delay here, right? So to get as much information in CAT in the most expedient time frames possible, we were looking for what is readily available for firms to report. What do they have in their systems that they could reasonably report in a shorter time frame? And these electronic type events are in a form that they could be reported. But rather than just say, oh, if it's not all perfectly pure electronic the whole way from start to finish, it's not in at all, we're going to lose a significant amount of scope. But in talking, and we did this in conjunction with the industry too, what could we do to pull in a lot of very valuable information, even if it's not perfect, and meaning that there will be unlinks if we have these manual steps intermittently. And people, I think the industry was willing to report what they could, but it was obviously concerned about what kind of compliance issue that would be if you have these unlinked events. So the idea was to have a flag that could be set that would indicate to CAT and their regulators, of course, that something either immediately or preceding or following won't be there to link. And it's what we call this next unlinked value. And it's the manual, a complex, or paired, kind of as we've already talked about. And so let's move on to the next slide. this is what it looks like. Like if you look at the spec, here are the unlinked values of what they mean. So you have next, what's coming next is either manual complex paired or it's not applicable. The one thing here, if you don't populate this, that just means we'll try to link it. So it's assuming if it's all electronic flow, don't worry about these flags. They, you know, if you can link it all, you don't have to do anything. And then on the prior, we have manual complex. And then nothing because you won't have gotten, if it's a pair, if you received it as a pair, you're not going to be reporting it anyway. So that just lays a little bit of foundation that I'm going to hopefully will help transition Essence to duty on how we start looking at some of these workflows.
Shelly,
oh, sorry, yes.
Yeah, so I think we'll keep it on the next level. We have next manual, next complex, next pair. And otherwise, you're going to try to link it.
Yes.
If there was no next event, so there's nothing done, or it was away from the market, not routed.
Right.
What do we do?
That is not, that's not what these flags are intended to do. So the nothing done is when all this is fully implemented, we won't have these flags anymore. And even like in an equity context as well, if you don't, if it, something's away from the market and nothing happens, there's nothing to report. So a new order without a route is going to be interpreted as nothing happens on that order.
Okay, but am I going to get flagged with some sort of intra-firm mismatch that's going to try to match it and something else isn't there?
Right, and I know this issue has come up with the IM and the IM Tech Spec Working Group about we probably need to put some language out or explain better, but that we are not looking to put any sort of flag because it would apply to everything into saying don't look for anything because nothing else happened in this order. That is not, this is in a different context, but I we do need to address that and to explain it better. So, Judy.
Okay, so I'm going to start, and the next set of slides are all concentrating on a mix of manual and electronic order flow, and I'll walk through the actual prior unlinked or next unlinked in detail for this first slide, but it's pretty mechanical. Really, most of these slides are trying to tease out the nuance of what's, in my case, manual or electronic, and then in Jennifer's case, on the complex orders, what needs to be reported. So let's just take a very simple case to start with where we have a non-broker dealer customer, and I'm on slide 14 here, and they phone or IM an order into a broker dealer. So again, this is not according to any protocol, so even if it's IM, that is considered a manual order. The broker dealer then records it on a paper ticket and enters it into his EMS and routes it to SIBO. So the only thing reportable here, because the only thing that's actually considered electronic is that route to SIBO. And so in that case, that route to SIBO will have a prior unlinked indicator of M. And so then let's go to the next example on slide 15. So this changes just a little bit. Again, we're trying to capture the nuance of what's considered manual or not. So there's a phone order and from a BD customer, the broker dealer records it in an order capture system. Even that is not considered electronic. That's still considered manual. But then they route it to the SIBO. That route is considered electronic, so that needs to be reported. Of course, with a prior unlinked flag. If we go to the next slide, slide 16, we have a situation where a broker-dealer receives an electronic order but then calls down to a floor broker. In this case, only the order accepted event will be reportable, and then and the next unlinked indicator will be manual because that's clearly a phone call, not electronic. So then let's go to the next slide 17. Here's a situation where a customer calls in an order but then chases it with an electronic order. And in this case, because the order was initially received verbally, that's out of scope for 2B. And so then the broker-dealer turns around and routes that to SIBO. Here, again, there will only be an order route event with the prior unlinked indicator of M.
So how do you identify the
So in most, you will have to. Now, in some cases, you can, I know for my firm, in some cases, these workflows, we're choosing to over-report initially because it's simpler. So you don't have to make that differentiation. But the caution is there, if you choose voluntarily to report early, it still has to be accurate and timely. So I think in some cases with these manual and electronic mixes, depending on the firm's specific situation with systems and workflows, it could be easier to report the full chain from the beginning.
In that example, do I also have to report the time that it was given over the telephone?
You would. If you chose to voluntarily report that, you would absolutely have to report those two timestamps. Okay, and now we'll go on to the next slide, slide 18. So here's a situation where there's a mix, even within a broker-dealer. So a broker-dealer receives an order electronically, but then, and so let's say that the sales desk receives that order electronically, but then verbally relays that order to, say, their position desk, and then the position desk electronically routes to the exchange. So here, the broker-dealer will report the new a new option order event with the next unlinked indicator. The verbal event will not be reported at all, and then the broker-dealer will pick up with recording the route to the exchange, again with a prior unlinked flag set.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
Written order capture systems are considered manual?
Yes.
And
so, again, going back to the definition, if that order was not received according to a standard format and directly ingested into a system, it's considered manual.
So that communication between the sales desk and the position desk,
mm-hmm.
May be sort of a proprietary order capture system, quote-unquote, so where's the sort of nuance between...
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
What's order capture and what?
Okay, so if you had a proprietary, that's a good question. If you had a proprietary protocol, if you had a proprietary protocol, it's an electronic communication.
I'm writing it down.
Okay.
presented that specific question that, so the firm would be fully integrated in terms of how this firm it would flow electronically into that prop system, out of that prop system electronically, no manual intervention. Is that basically the...
And it may leverage FIPS.
Okay.
But even if you had an internal protocol, right, if you had an internal protocol that you abided by, you know, I think that then you can throw that up against the definition and make a decision.
Yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no downside in reporting all of it voluntarily. But if there's a challenge there, you know, if we could get a little bit more, say, the challenge, why it's not readily available to the firm, and we could address that directly.
If the firm, if the commission does have a firm or a capacity, is that maybe portable?
Could you say that one more time?
If the position goes out in a firm or a capacity, basically a principal order, link to the customer agency order, we can report that firm order after manual
based on
all that.
So I don't think the concept of a firm order, a representative order, other than a unique, very narrow, or not unique, but a very narrow combined order scenario, and I would look to the exchange law, I don't think that necessarily is recognized or allowed, or however, you know, Jennifer, you want to take that one.
Yeah. And I just want to make sure I understand. You know, you have a custom order, and then you have a firm proprietary order. You want to pair with it, or
no,
you're
unrelated. It's sales desk, county
and just you, so the firm is just initiating an order on their side. So the origination of the order would be verbal, and then when you route that order, you would record the route of it. That would be electronic if you're electronically routing it, or if you call it down, it's verbal, so then it's not recordable in a CD. Depends what it is you're doing with the prop order with the firm. If you're routing it electronically or if you're manually
The origination of an independent firm order printed on
Well, it depends how you originate it. If it's originated manually, if someone at the firm manually originates it, yeah, that's phase two, I believe, before we can confirm, I mean, that's 2D, versus if you have a system that's generating a proprietary order, so it's electronically. So then there's
but are you suggesting that fill from the prop order is used to fill the customer order?
I think
it can
be allocated later.
So the customer order is never routed anywhere outside of the firm?
That's
like a riskless principle? And with riskless principle, we tend not to have very many of those scenarios happen in the option space. I know we have riskless principle scenarios on the stock side.
But you're talking options.
If it's options, we have slides later where we talk about representative orders or combined orders where you have basically a proxy order that's used to represent a collective of customer orders that you send down to exchange and you post-trade to allocate to those combined orders, and maybe that's something that's akin to the scenario.
But if you don't find your exact scenario, if you could do it to make sure we're accurately giving all the flows. I mean, that's sort of an overriding thing, too. Any flow we don't get to here that you need an answer, we are looking for flows we haven't identified that we need to provide guidance on. So that's part of the exercise.
Okay, I will pick up with slide 19. So here we're featuring typical option wholesaler workflows. So here's a non-BD customer electronically routing to a broker-dealer and electronically routing to a second broker-dealer, the wholesaler, and then the wholesaler calls down to the floor. The only thing that BD2 will need to report in this case is the option order accepted event, and with the next unlink as M. And of course, BD1, that's all electronic from his point of view, and so he'll be reporting a new option order and an option route. And so this really highlights between BD1 and BD2, they do not need to know what each other are reporting, and that's the beauty of that's the whole design behind this prior and next unlink, is that the BD1 and BD2 report independently, and it doesn't cause breakages in the attempts to do linkages. And then the next example I'll skip over because it just becomes manual a little bit earlier in the chain. And now I'll hand it off to Jennifer.
So the next scenario is an example where you start with a complex order and then it's split into individual legs. So broker-dealer receives a complex order and they decide they want to leg it out and trade each leg separately and not tied as a complex transaction. So complex orders are not part of 2B, they're 2D. So when in this scenario you have a non-BD customer submitting a complex order to the BD, the receipt of that order is not part of 2B because it's a complex order. Then the BD routes out to the exchange. Here we have four separate orders. So the simple orders he routes out separately to the exchange. Those four orders would be reportable in 2B because they're being represented as simple electronic orders. So you have on the receipt side a complex order, and you'd code that an unlinked for complex. And then the routing out to the exchange, you'd have four separate orders going out electronically. Any questions on that one? Okay. The next slide is just a slight deviation on it. It's adding in another broker-dealer, so you can see it routing through the daisy chain a little bit further. So here, non-BD customer sends a complex order to BD1, and then BD1 is routing four legs to BD2. Who then in turn routes four legs to the exchange. So BD1 here, the receipt of the customer order, so the order receipt side is a complex order, so there's no reportable event there. So the prior unlinked would be C. And BD1, when they send the four legs out to the next broker-dealer, would be electronically reporting those four legs because they're four simple option orders. And then BD2, from their perspective, everything's electronic. Oops, sorry.
And those single orders
order sent out, we'll have a separate order ID?
Yes, there are four separate orders. And you might even, from the internally at the broker, you would have an original complex order that has the child orders with them. So they would have the four separate order IDs. And then, so BD2 would receive four separate order IDs from BD1. And then BD2 might assign its own when it routes it out to the exchange as well. And from BD2's perspective, this is an all-electronic experience. They've received four simple-legged orders, and then they've routed on four simple-legged orders. So they're purely electronic in theirs. Any questions on that? Okay. So then if we go on to the next slide, this is, I think, getting at some of the questions that folks had asked earlier about solicitation. So as we said before, paired orders, so if you have a buy and a sell order that you submit into an exchange electronically, are not part of 2B, they're in 2D. So what this is trying to demonstrate here, for example, if any folks in the room here use the electronic auction mechanisms at the different options exchanges, like AIM, on NYSE it's CUBE, PIP, PIM, there's all different auction mechanisms. This is basically trying to get at those scenarios here for you. So in this scenario here, BD1 gets an electronic order, a simple order from a customer, and then BD1 has some sort of mechanism where they go out and solicit the other side and receive responses back, and eventually they pair it up and submit a paired order into the exchange. So the original receipt of the customer order, which is electronic, is reportable in phase 2B. The solicitation out and the responses you get back is not 2B, that's 2D. And frankly, the simplest answer is it's just too complicated to nail it all down yet, so we're waiting till later to figure it out. So that's coming later. You don't have to report that now. And when you submit the paired orders into the exchange, that's, again, 2D, not B. It's the later phase because of the complexity of submitting paired orders. So what this is trying to demonstrate that, in this particular scenario, the only thing you're reporting to CAT in 2B is the receipt of the customer order.
So even if a broker-dealer sends you an electronic order, that's still not reported?
It depends. If broker-dealer 2 sends you an electronic order that you're going to pair with that customer order and submit in as a paired order, that broker-dealer 2 order that you've received is not reportable in 2B. It will come later in D, but not 2B. There's a slight deviation on the next slide, though, that shows a little bit of a different scenario. And there's actually one later in the slide deck, too, where you don't pair them, and we can get to that, too. So in this, we'll go to this. Oh, sorry, Will.
Does that change in any way if you were laying off trades with a customer? So BD2 is no longer a broker-dealer, but an actual exchange counterparty?
Doesn't matter who it is. If it's a public customer or broker-dealer, who's your contra side order in the auction? Is that who you're sorry to make?
The auction grants the auction message down to the exchange. But let's say I call another national counterpart customer, and they send me another fixed order in order to initiate the order. So now I have a buy and a seller, both customers. Mm-hmm. Pair up. That pair is not reportable, but is the order origination from the two customers? The first one, obviously.
The second one is not. So whoever you've solicited, whether it's a broker-dealer or a customer, that one, let me make sure that I have that right.
It's the response to an auction.
Yes.
So at high level, responses to auctions, we don't have guidance yet because that's 2B. But you're saying your system just sees it coming in as a single, simple order?
Yeah, so customer A calls us and says they want to buy some contract. I call around and I find an actual counterparty that's in their stock.
Right.
They're not broker-dealer. The transaction would be rural or by IM. They accept it to take the other side of the trade. When I actually use PIN, which is sure that the people are cross, that transaction is obviously not reportable because that's the actual pair.
Right.
But the order origination event from customer two, who is my layoff, I would think because they're fixing an order for me.
I think we had this conversation about it might be difficult for people to suppress that if we say do not report that because it's part of the solicitation process that just goes way down other roads very fast. I don't think we would, if you reported that, and you marked it correctly and everything about it was accurate, I don't think that that would be a very, like Judy mentioned, you could certainly report that quickly. We wouldn't, it wouldn't be a violation or a problem for you failing to suppress it.
But the bottom line is not required.
Right, it's not required. If it's part of that solicitation process. That's
and I think it's something that we could look at the slides and make it clear, because the slide, to your point, the particular example in the slide is you're soliciting BD2. We could do another slide that shows you're soliciting customer 2 or whatever, not or non-BD, to illustrate that it's optional. That's something we could.
And if I reported that voluntarily, do I have to mark it C prepared?
I think that, yes. I think it would look like the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great question. So this next slide just takes a little twist on the scenario. So all the steps of it are the same at the beginning. You have original customer order and you solicit and get a pair back. But in this instance, the pair back is only for a partial fill. So the original customer is 100 and what you get back on the paired side is 60 contracts. And the broker-dealer decides basically he's going to route paired order for 60 through some paired auction at an exchange. And then we'll say SIBO, that's what this scenario says. And then separately, he's just going to route a straight, simple 40 contracts to ISE to be executed. So this is a mixed bag kind of scenario. BD1 would report the original receipt of the 100 contract order from the customer. BD2 would not need to report the contra side 60 contracts that he received in the solicitation. BD1 also, when they route the paired order onto SIBO, they don't need to report that because, again, it's a paired order. They would just put the indicator on that it's paired onto the exchange. But for the 40 contracts, that's basically sailing through just as a simple 40 contract order. So they would report that they've routed out electronically to ISE 40 contracts. For the 40, yeah. Any questions on that one?
Actually, I think, and to make sure I heard your question correctly, the 40 contract electronic order that's getting routed, that's not out of priority because that's the route off of the 100.
Yes, I have a question.
Oh,
should be blank, yes, because there's not a prior, yeah. And actually, then, too, I think on the 60 that's routed paired, do you put anything in there at all since it's a mixed bag?
It's not reportable.
Yeah, it's
wouldn't
not reportable. You would put in it at all.
Right.
Yeah.
The 100 from the customer, what would be the next?
There would not
be one. Not be one. What won't throw an error is if you have a route, but it's not for the full quantity of the parent. So 100 with a 40 route isn't going to kick an error.
So
it's
just I have a remainder, like in this scenario,
right. That only is I didn't find anything at all, and I know to Michael's point about that being done, but that's what that was about. There's a complete absence of something as opposed to there's something here.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions on that? Okay. So if we move on to the next slide. This is starting to look at some actual complex order scenarios that come through. So the slide basically here is noting that for 2B, if a member sends or receives a complex order electronically as individual simple complex order legs, the preferred approach is that you suppress and that you not report those to CAT because it is a complex order. We can get into some examples of that later, but it's basically if you receive a complex order as a different messages, like that looks like a simple order, but you have instructions or a way of understanding that it's intended to be a complex order. So in reality, it is a complex order. The preference is that you suppress that and not report it to CAT, and to B, that you wait and report it later with other complex orders. But if you do choose to report it. We want you to report the whole life cycle and indicate the handling instruction that it is a complex order so that we can link all the individual legs together.
So that's just create the order, however, it's not support the event. Create the event, it's not support the event.
Say that again. Create.
So complex indicates the source and the end of the instruction. You want the event created, however, it's the present.
Well, I think it's just a complex, even if you, you know, spawn off individual electronic messages, the preferred is don't give us anything. But if you can't suppress or don't want to suppress the individual legs being spawned off, you have to mark them as complex so we don't interpret them as the whole order. Which gives the parent at all. I think maybe the next slide.
And maybe it'll help illustrate it a little better. Okay. So this next slide is showing it's a complex electronic order mix. So here, a verbal phone order that's a complex order is provided to the BD from their non-broker-dealer customer, and then the customer follows up with four fixed messages that they have some sort of understanding in the background that those four fixed messages are supposed to be combined together to reflect the complex order. Here, because it's a complex order, even though you receive four separate legs, four orders coming in, it is a complex order. They have an understanding of it that it is a complex. It is not reportable in phase 2B. So the broker-dealer then routes on to an exchange, a single complex order in the scenario. There's nothing reportable at all in this scenario because on the front end, it really is a complex order, even though it looks like it's four separate orders through fixed messages. It was a verbal order, and it really is intended to be a complex order. And then on the back end of the outbound route to the exchange, it's a complex order. That's not 2B. That's a later phase. So there's nothing to report in this scenario. Does that make sense?
How much is
the first one? Yes. So the first one's kind of on two, you could stop at that point.
That's
this one.
Preferred.
Yeah, that's the preferred.
But
now,
firms that said, I have these fixed messages, and for me to go from now to suppress them is very difficult. So we're just trying to accommodate that. But yes, you cannot give us anything if you need.
Yep. So then the preferred is that you not report it and you stop, but there are instructions if you need to report it because it's easier, or so if you voluntarily want to, you could report it and you would put the handling instruction on there that it is a complex.
What does FINRA do with the complex? Is it ignored them or is it
advised to do both? It would basically ignore them. Yeah. The next thing is the complex out, so there's nothing to do in this interim phase. When we get to 2G, we'll have to build around out all around this with the parent and individual legs being linked and all of that. So that being not that part of that.
Well, when you run formatting and syntax, like if you ended up reporting,
no,
you'd still run formatting.
Yes, we would ignore in terms of linkages, but to Dave's point, we're going to make sure the record passes, you know, data syntax advantage. Right, exactly.
This next slide, I think we're on 26 now, is just another illustration where there's no phone order involved here, but there's a version of six where an individual sends in three simple orders to the broker-dealer, and they're intended to be combined together to be a complex order. So in reality, it is a complex order, even though it's routed electronically as three separate orders. And then the broker then routes on a complex order to the exchange. Again, here, there is nothing that is required to be reported in 2B because it's a complex order in and then a complex order out. But again, the broker could choose to report the receipt in of the three separate legs into CAT and just put the complex order indicator on there so that we know it's related to a complex order. Any questions on that one? The next slide is just adding in one more layer to it where you have broker-dealers, multiple broker-dealers in the chain. And so here, originally a customer sends a complex order electronically to BD1, and then BD1 when it's communicating with BD2, verbally calls BD2 with the complex order and then separately sends four fixed messages for the four legs of the complex order. And from there, BD2 routes in a single complex order onto the exchange. Again, through this whole package, it's complex throughout. There's no need to report in phase 2B. But if you choose to report, the four legs that are reported between BD1 and BD2, you can do the same where you would report the individual legs and put the complex indicator on there. Are there any questions on that scenario? Okay. This next one, again, is just one more variation on the scenarios again. Here it's a complex order coming in, and BD1 has four fixed messages, so there's no phone call in between. It's just sending three fixed messages for simple orders going across. And then BD2 routes the complex order to the exchange. A very similar scenario. It's just the difference is there's no phone call in between here, but the outcome is basically the same, where there's nothing reportable, but you can choose to report if you want to. Any questions?
Okay. So we're going to move on to the next topic here, combined order. So this touches a little bit on what can sometimes be referred to as a representative order, but it's not exactly the same as in the equity space. And essentially, it's where you take multiple customer orders and you're aggregating them and sending them as a single order to an exchange. Again, with the caveat that this is, you know, subject to applicable SRO rules, and however you're combining and routing is allowed by the particular exchange you're routing to. I think what might be easier, if we can reverse the order of these slides, go into slide 30 real quick, just to put the picture in front of everyone. So we've got three simple electronic orders coming in, 30 contracts, or let's just say it's 10 contracts, and so then you decide, well, I'm just going to send a single 30-contract order to the exchange. So in CAT, we have to be able to link each of these individual orders to the exchange order, and importantly, the fill that they each got. So if you have, you've got three different orders, three different client order IDs, et cetera, so you're not going to be able to do that without having that intermediate firm order, that not prop, we'll take that in a separate conversation, but what you have to do, the requirement is that you report each of these simple electronic orders. Then you're going to create another separate new order that's going to represent the combined order to the exchange. And in the spec, we have a field called a representative indicator on new events. And that is intended to say this order was originated to represent some other order. And in this, in the options scenario, you will populate that with a value of O to indicate option. There's a many different values for equities. They have a lot more in this space than options. There's a single value here, O for option. Then once you get the fill off the exchange and you turn around and you're going to allocate to each of these individual customer orders, you will have to report an order fulfillment against each order that shows the contracts and the price that went to the customer. And in the fulfillment link type flag there, you're going to put O to tell you this fill came off of a represented or a combined, we use the word combined in the option space, a combined order. And that's all you have to do in 2D, in 2B as in boy, is put the O on the exchange-facing order and the O on the fulfillments on the customer order. But what you'll have to do in 2D as in David is on that exchange-facing order, you're going to have to put the order ID of each of these three orders in this aggregated order ID field, just so you can start planning, so that we know that exchange-facing order represents these three specific orders. And then when you report the fulfillment in 2D as in David, you're going to have to put the order ID of the exchange-facing order, and that will create the entire life cycle. And you need it at the exchange-facing leg in case it doesn't fill, so you still know the orders that were being represented, and then on the fill side. So it's an order-level linkage and a fulfillment-level linkage. So hopefully that makes sense. Any questions on that one? All right, so I'm going to hand it back to Judy for some wholesaler scenarios.
So we've, to make it easier for those who are options wholesalers, we've pulled in all the different scenarios into this one section. We've actually covered most of this material already, so I'll go fairly quickly. So the first, on slide 32, this is just a very simple workflow of a broker-dealer receiving an order, an electronic order from a customer, electronically sending to the wholesaler, and then electronically sending to the exchange. All of this is reportable. It's all electronic. So just basic workflow, no surprises there. On the next page, we have, and we have seen this before, we have this mix of manual and electronic order flow. I'll just pause there. Are there any questions on this and how the BD2 is the wholesaler, how he would do his reporting to CAT? And then we'll go to the next slide, slide 34. Similarly, this is, we're just highlighting that the wholesaler here is receiving the four fixed messages representing a complex order. Everything that Jennifer took us through holds here equally. Any questions on this? And then there's just a slight variation in slide 35. And slide 36, again, emphasizing in this case where we have BD1, receives an order from a customer and then routes electronically to the wholesaler. The wholesaler then goes through a solicitation process to obtain the other side and then sends a paired order to CBO. Any questions on this? Everything that we talked about earlier holds, and again, the BD1 and BD2 can report independently, and all of this works very well, thanks to the prior unlinked flag. Okay, and now we'll go into just a couple other 2B scenarios, and these are just to add a little bit of clarity around just certain scenarios that came up in all of our industry member tech stack working group discussions. So going to page or slide 38, so this is an order flow that's colloquially known as post and facilitate. So here a broker-dealer customer is electronically sending an order to BD1. The BD1 sends the customer order to the exchange, and then 1 second later sends his own interest on the other side. And so there's no surprises here. Every step is reportable. It's all electronic. And then we'll go to slide 39. So we'll cover responses to auctions on this slide. So it's important to note that responses to auctions of simple orders or auctions of paired simple orders, the responses to those are reportable in 2B. And so to walk through the diagram here, Box sends out an auction message. The market makers respond with an electronic message. And what needs to be reported in this case is that each of the market makers are going to respond with their new option order event as well as the route event. And so, of course, in the case where if this were a complex option, nothing would be reported in this whole scenario. Any questions on that? Okay, I will hand it back to Brandy.
And just a little quick report. So that ends our workflow discussion, but just to reiterate, for any workflows you didn't cover, please let us send that to us. You can send call the help desk or send an email so we can get it on the phone with you, or I think it's about tech support. So then I'll hand it over to Sam.
So we're going to have the OSI symbology list. So that's going to be available on the CAT website on mid-July, July 15th. So anything that will be sent in at OSI. Is that up now?
No. The sample is not. We have distributed a sample list through the IM Tech Spec Working Group to get a little bit of feedback before we publish it on the website to make sure we have the formats correctly. So we've already gotten the first round of feedback, especially around concepts. IDs and how to handle that with flex option comments. So we're working through that. We'll be working with the exchanges on that, and the plan is to have all that worked out in a good format to publish the full sample list on July 15th, and then once we move into implementation, will be a start of day, end of day file, so you can come in the morning, pick it up, the end of day, we'll get your intraday changes.
And remember to register. Make sure you're registered at the CAT website. We don't have – everyone's not registered, but it's very important that you all go and register. Is everyone registered? Do you know to register? Please go to the CAT website and register.
If you haven't registered, we will probably be calling you soon. And if you don't respond to Summer CAT, we'll probably let your SRO know that you haven't responded. So.
I'll have Jimmy call up. I think Michael has a question.
Yeah.
One other question. So when you round to a floor broker, I presume that they're the IMID. So when you round to a floor broker, what kind of documents do they need to have? Any update on those
maybe
public?
The
IMID
is... Yeah, I don't have that date off the top of my head. I don't remember, but it is being it's in the works, and we will be publishing a list every day of all the IMIDs that can be used.
So for the current registration, I was still on the phone that we can just use the code.
That's correct. So the IMID for CAT can be any SRO assigned identifier that you choose. It's your choice. So it can be a SIBO identifier, it can be an IC identifier, it does not have to be your FINRA MPID if you're a FINRA member, whatever you want, but it just has to be an SRO assigned identifier. Okay, well, we have 7 minutes left based on my clock. We could dive into some FDID. Is everyone game for diving into some FDID? Are there any questions before we do that? All right, and we'll understand if people get up and leave as they start here. So I think when we talk about FDID, obviously brand new for CAT. So this is not in existence anywhere. So, of course, understandably, there are a lot of questions. There are, in under Rule 613, so this is the very first step in collecting the customer and account information that will ultimately be part of CAT that will, while we're not going to store any customer and real account information with transaction data for obvious security reasons, we still have to have a way to go from the transaction data to the customer and account data. And that's the point of CAT, right? So we can do, the regulators can look at the transaction data and understand how a single customer is trading across broker-dealers or across within a broker-dealer across accounts and things like that. So that's the primary objective here. FDID, firm designated ID, is the first step in giving us a linkage between the transaction data and allowing us to come over and find the ultimate customer information that we need. So before we dive into more details about it, I think the best way to try and lay a foundation is to make sure everyone understands the basic concepts under Rule 613, because many of the conversations we've had so far, there's a lot, customer and account gets conflated very quickly about what, well, we're talking about a customer or we're talking about an account. So in CAT, under Rule 613, there are two separate and distinct things. There's customers, and they get represented by the CAT customer ID, or CCID, and that represents an individual, an institution. We're going to get to some examples quickly about what examples of that CCID would be. The second separate and distinct concept is a trading account.
And that is what is represented by the firm designated ID, the concept of a trading account. There's, we'll talk about in just a minute, if you have institutional relationships where there's not account structures, things like that build onto the complexity, but at a very basic level, it's accounts. So a customer can obviously have many trading accounts, and a trading account can obviously have many customers as account holders or authorized traders. So those are the two fundamental thing, you know, concepts, CCID and FDID, two separate and distinct things. So if we want to move on to the next slide here, under 613, so when we talk about customer, there's two kinds of customers. There is account holder, beneficial owner, pretty basic, and then there's any person who's authorized to accept trading instructions for an account. So that in CAT is part of the customer definition, and those people, except in limited circumstances for employees of a firm, and we'll talk about it in just a second, get their own CCID. So if you want to see, the objective here is when the regulators are looking at the data, if there's a money manager or, you know, some other type of individual who's making trading decisions for many accounts that are unrelated from in terms of a beneficial owner or account holder, that authorized trader is the key, and they need to be able to see that, and by assigning these individual CCIDs, it lets them have that visibility. Okay, so let's move on then to the next, and just to put a plug in to this deck that I'm working from right now is posted on CAT NMS plan. We did a webinar, I don't know, a month or so ago. There's a recording of it along with the Q&A if you want to take the time to dive in deeper. I'm going to try to go kind of quickly here, but there is that presentation there. All right, so who would have a CCID? Individuals, financial advisors, like we just talked about, institutions, money managers. And the one point to make here is I mentioned there was an exception on any individual's trading authorizations, except an individual with trading authorization that is employed by the entity that's the account holder. So think a prop trading account at a firm and all the traders that trade that account. We're not looking for a CCID on each of the traders trading the firm's account because they're employees of the account holder itself. That would also work, though, for a non-broker dealer, you know, a fund or somebody who's trading their own prop and they have traders that are trading that account that are employed by the account holder. So just point that out. All right, so we can move on to the next slide. This one, the trading accounts, under CAT, like I said, FDID, the points I'm trying to pull out quickly, the main points here, the industry participant must assign a single FDID that is unique to each account, and the important point here is it has to be unique and persistent across days. So the idea is to be able to identify and look at, for the regulators to look at the activity in a particular account across time. So it can't change every day or you lose your ability to do that. And it obviously has to be unique inside of a firm. So you can look at a unique account over time. There's an FAQ out that gets into that. Multiple vendors, so one of the first things that has been raised by the industry is I have multiple third-party vendors that all report orders for me that might involve the same account. And does each vendor have to have the same FDID? And the answer is yes. And yes, we recognize that creates challenges and may be difficult, but that is the requirement. So again, regardless of the vendor who's submitting the data, the regulators can look at a single account within a firm over time across all the activity. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. So I alluded to on the FDID because there's never anything super cut and dry and simple with no exception. So here's first one of the major issues with FDID being a trading account. That was raised by the industry, I think, years ago, like at the initial inception and was worked through. There's actually exemptive relief for this, where in certain institutional managed account scenarios, maybe the account structure itself isn't available at the time the order is first placed. And I think the easiest way is to just dive into this example. So a firm has industry member A, has big fund manager as a client. And in all of firm A's front office systems, front end systems where the orders are coming in, they only know big fund manager. Those systems only have BFM1. They don't have an actual account number. And so when the order is first placed, what the exemption relief allows is for that industry member to put as the FDID BFM1 instead of reaching in and trying to actually find a top account number or something like that if that's not how it's structured in their system. So just one concept to make sure no one starts confusing, though, with this is a relationship ID is not a CCID. So while you're saying BFM1 to identify big fund manager, that is not how CAT is going to find out who big fund manager is. Big fund manager is going to be identified with the CCID, and that's where their LTID, LEI, tax ID, name, address, all that will be there. FDID is just the link to take you to get that information. So let's move on. We're 1 minute over. Quick note, you cannot use an actual account number to report the FDID. You have to somehow mask it or otherwise transform it so it can't be used to affect a transaction. If it were compromised, this is all about data security, obviously. Yes?
You know that the firm FDID has to be assigned by, how about the CCID?
So that's a great question and is a topic that's under considerable discussion right now. The firms themselves will not be creating the CCID. The whole mechanical process about how that is actually going to be accomplished, starting with a social security number, which no one wants retained in CAD. So this is a whole analysis that's underway right now with industry input and representation of how you're going to have to provide enough information for the processor to be able to transform that into a unique number that will be the same across all broker-dealers. So that is in development, but the firm won't have something called CCID that it directly reports to CAT. Okay, just one quick note before we leave masking your own prop accounts. If you don't want to mask those, you don't have to. It would be your own call about whether you felt if the data were compromised, you would have issues with your own prop account numbers being there.
Relationship IDs, if they're not known to the customer, the public, it's just an internal identifier, but also
We have not made an official stance on that, but I'm going to remind myself that we need to, I think, if you stay within those guardrails of you can't affect a transaction with it and it wouldn't be considered customer and account information under the definition of that in the plan, I think that would be fine, but we haven't issued like an FAQ on that. All right, moving on to the next slide. So examples of FDIDs, customer account, individual, institutional. One thing perhaps to highlight here is this also would include any firm average price account numbers. So, for example, that combined option scenario we just talked about where you might take your 3, 10 contract orders and send them out as a single 30 contract order. If you're doing that through some firm average price agency, average price account, when you put the 30 contract new order into CAT, the FDID should be your firm's average price account or an FDID representing that, not the customer. If you are trading for your market making account, the FDID could be your own trading market making account number, your own trading account number. All right, we'll move on. So we thought what might be helpful, and it's 5:34, time check. I can stop or I can keep going. What, people want to keep going and you just get up and leave if you've had enough? Okay, that's fine. All right. So this slide is intended to try to help illustrate what kinds of events these numbers would be on. And in 2B for options, this you only have the new orders themselves, client orders or firm orders. The sub-account allocations, which get reported in allocation reports to CAT, do not come into play till 2D, as in David. So in the 2B time frame on your new, and I think I said this already, but these FDIDs are only on the top order, only on a new order event. These are never on an order accept. You do not pass this between broker-dealers. Only the firm with a customer account reports it. And then all those linkages we talk about is how you get from the exchange or wherever back to the originating customer. So another thing that I think has concerned people over time is that these are somehow getting passed between broker-dealers, and that is not true. It's just on the firm who received the order. So it's either a new client order or your own firm order where this would apply. And if it's a client order, it's like your retail account number would be one example, or an institutional account number, or we talked about this relationship ID on your firm order, your trading account number. And then when you get to the sub-account allocations in 2D, that will always be the actual trading account. So big fund manager we just talked about that you have the relationship ID on, 2D, when big fund manager comes in with their allocations, here's my five accounts this goes to, that's where you're going to put the customer account on the sub-account allocations. It won't be on big fund manager's new order. So hopefully, is that any questions on that? All right, let's move to the next slide. So this is, and probably is most helpful if you go to the web and pull this presentation down. This is just try a little slow to try to help people lock in and hone in on whether they're doing a relationship ID or an account number. We have lots of questions on that, account number in the form of an FDID. So I'll skip over that right now. Move on to the next slide. This slide is intended to illustrate once we eventually populate the customer and account data. So when I first started, the FDID on the transaction data is essentially your linkage key to take you to all this other information. So when we move into that customer and account phase, the specs have not even started in development yet. So there's not a magic customer and account spec out there that we haven't shared. It will be in significant consultation with the industry, lots of conversations. But this is intended to just give a preview of what kind of information based on what 613 requires is most likely to be there. So here's your FDID, and then what are you going to come in and tell CAT, customer and account information, about the FDID that represents? So it would be the account number, the date or the effective date of the account, the kind of account. Again, this is TBD, but we're talking about things like, remember we have the account holder type on the transaction data that tells us individual, institution. That's not this. This would be like, is it a cash account, a margin account, DVP, RVP, that kind of thing. The customer type, we haven't even gone there yet, but the rule does require a customer type. And then LTID would be there. I know discussions about if there's ways to expedite LTID given large trader phase three, but right now LTID would be intended in the account information. Any questions on this?
Yes. One way of thinking about the differentiation between CCID and FDID is FDID is reported on transactions.
Yes.
CCID just exists.
That is exactly right. I'm thinking, I wonder if it would be Nathan or whoever, we've got people driving this presentation, that's who I'm talking to. If you could go forward a couple of slides until we get to that first example that might, I'm sorry, we ended it on this presentation. On our website, Alan, to your point, and I apologize, I think you can go back. The customer and account information is in a separate database that is housed separately. It has separate authentication, separate security protocols. It's very separate and distinct. So the transaction data comes in. The plan processor, ultimately when this is all completed, will build essentially taking that customer and account information, which will include a CCID, however that ends up coming out through the technical implementation, will take all the CCIDs and build an FDID to CCID mapping table
just those two values, right? This FDID has all these CCIDs. So then you can bump it against the transaction data as a regulator and say, I want to see all the trades that have the same CCID. Just that number, that benign by itself number. And that will let you look and see, oh, all these different trades had the same CCID. Then if a regulator has a need to know and has a regulatory reason to go find out who that CCID belongs to in an investigation context, they, with the right authentication, can go into that customer and account database and find out who that customer is. So, that is right. That is right. So, like myself, I could have a joint account with my husband, I could have a single account, you know, whatever. It would come back and tell me all those accounts. So that's the sort of high-level FDID. And no one has left yet. are there any questions?
Yeah, I'm still confused how this gets managed, pushed out to the world that we all know about.
On the FDID or the CCID? No, so the FDID would have to be created and generated by each firm. So each firm knows its account numbers, and it takes each account number. You can't give us the real account number. Trading accounts. Your customer's trading account. So client A comes in and their account number is 789 on your books and records, your account, that's their account number. And so in its purest form, you could just put 789 in the order records. You can't do that. You got to take 789 and transform it in some way. Yes, yeah, so when you report your new order, so that client for account number 789 gives you a new order. You now have to report that new order to CAT. When you report that new order to CAT, you're going to put some version, transform version of 789 in the FDID field to CAT.
Gotcha. Now, you were saying there's some linkages along the way
So, separately, in the customer and account phase, you're also going to have to come in and tell CAT for 789, account 789, this is the FDID, I named it, and here's all the customers on it. Here's their information. We'll get them magically the CCID in there with it. Yeah. So the participant has to populate that customer and account data based on a spec that's not yet developed. That the spec, I think, is January 2021. It's in that first slide. Will be the spec. It's not implemented until July 2022. The spec for all of that, January 2021. Then you have until the test environment will open January 2022, so you've got a year basically to build it. And then it goes to prod and fully implemented July 2022. So we have some time out. And the reason we have such a long period too between the spec and the test is because we're quite sure there's going to be a million different variations and questions, and none of this is going to be as easy as it sounds. So, not that it sounds super, but it's a long, painful process in front of us. But we'll get there.
Without Social Security number.
Without Social Security number, but it's going to happen. Any other questions?
If you look at the CAT data of T+1, is it going to have the voluntary data that you submit as well in there?
Yes. Yes. Any voluntarily submitted data will be included in the data just as if we, you know, on its surface, I don't think we're going to be able to readily tell this was voluntary and this was required, so it'll just flow through with the data. Yes.
And Sherry, when it comes to that, do you consider the QGOPS, that file, and the
So some of that is clearing movements. That's not subject to CAT. And then the allocate, a lot of that complexity comes in 2C for equities and 2D for options when the sub-account allocations have to be reported. And the prime brokers have to report allocations and all of that. So, yes. I would just say there clearing data is not part of CAT. So we're going to have to be very clear and careful about what's a pure clearing movement versus what's a sub-account allocation. And we're going to get into all that in 2C and 2D. The FDID is exactly the same for 2A and 2B. Yeah, there's no difference between equities and options for that. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you for your patience in staying over. All right, operator, we are done. We're going to end the call now. Thank you.
That does it for the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask you to please disconnect your line.